our book starts from the premise, and this is a premise that is very old in its pedigree. It's certainly not new with us, that the very first political order in any society is the sexual political order established between men and women. And we argue, along with many, many other scholars, that the character of that first order molds the society, its governance, and its behavior. Two roughly equal-sized groups, neither of which can reproduce without the other. The future actually literally depends on their interaction, must decide some very political things. And oftentimes I tell my students, consider that we're in a video game design class rather than a gender analysis class. And I tell you, the only two parameters for a game I want you to make is that you have two groups that are roughly equal in size, and there is no round two unless they cooperate. Make me a game. And they start asking me questions that every political scientist will recognize. Do these two groups stand before each other as equals or as superiors and inferiors? Will decisions for the group be made by largely one of these two subgroups or by both together? Will conflicts between the two groups be resolved peacefully or by force and domination? And of course, the ultimate political question, will resources be distributed equally between the two subgroups? Or can one group commandeer those resources? These are all deeply political questions, and we believe that the answers to these questions, as concerns men and women, establish the first political order within any society. Now, for a very long time, if someone asked me how would I operationalize women's empowerment? How would I see whether women and men were roughly equal or not within a society? I would say, well, let's look at female literacy, female labor force participation, and female parliamentary representation. And yet over time, I began to be uneasy with those. And a crucial conversation took place about 13 years ago when my university hosted the first wave of female Afghan MPs, members of parliament. And I was hosting one particular legislator, and she and I were having lunch, and I was saying, isn't it wonderful? Here you are, you're university educated, you're a doctor, you're now a member of the Loya Jirga, you know, this is just awesome. And she said, well, wait. You may think of me as empowered, but I could go home today. My husband could say I divorced you three times and I would be divorced. And if he did, I would not have custody of my children. Indeed, I would not even have a place to live because my father's family would not take me in. So even if I'm not divorced, I may have little say in who my children marry or at what age they marry. So how empowered am I really? And then I began to know that the nation with the highest percentage of female legislators is Rwanda, where women still are deeply subordinated. Female literacy in Saudi Arabia is extremely high. Female labor force participation is very high in countries where we would consider that women are still fairly subordinated. So we decided to dig deeper and look at the household level, the kinds of questions that female MP was directing us to. How much say does a woman have about getting married? How old is she on average when she's married? How much say does a woman have within her marriage? What types of property and inheritance rights do women have? Are there inequities in family law, such as in matters of divorce and child custody, as she was discussing? Is marriage patrilocal, where brides move to the groom's family's compound? Are bride price or dowry paid? Is polygyny or cousin marriage prevalent? Does society view domestic violence and femicide as normal, even expected, even in some cases obligatory? And is rape treated primarily as a property crime against a woman's guardian, either her husband or her father? We think that this really unveils, if you will, what the first political order in a society is. So if we were to map this out, we see what we call a series of interlocking mechanisms that are designed to keep women subordinated. If we start in the top left-hand corner, something that never disappears, right, is the willingness by males to violently coerce females to get what they would want. And we see this even in more advanced societies like the United States, even in Sweden, for goodness sakes. But we can also see that some societies have created these more systematic mechanisms. So out of that willingness to use violence, we begin to see male control over access to valuable resources, and women begin to be disenfranchised from property and inheritance rights. As that happens, we begin to see that the family gets to be defined in terms of the male line, that the men are the family and women will marry out and marry in, but resources and power remain with the male kin, and patrilocal marriage, of course, as an offshoot of that. As a result, if your family is the male kin, there will be son preference and begin to be a devaluation of the lives of daughters and wives, resulting in a lower age of marriage for girls because they are not really part of the family and they are more of a burden after they reach the age of puberty. And as such, all of these things begin to influence family and personal status laws, and these begin to be deeply inequitable, favoring men over women. Coming up the left-hand side, we see sort of two interesting versions of this. If women's labor is valuable, we begin to see the creation of a society that includes both polygyny and bride price. If women's labor is deemed not valuable, then we usually begin to see a system where dowry and sex ratio alteration begin to arise. So we view this as almost a syndrome, as a series of interlocking magnetic beads. And if you have one, you're liable to have more than one. If you have three or four, you're liable to have five or six of these, as they just hang together so nicely, creating a syndrome, if you will, of the subordination of women. But we're here to tell you that it's really a monster of frightening men. And that this monster of the subordination of women, the straitjacketing of women, if you will, through this syndrome, harms not just women, but children, men, and whole societies. For the syndrome is really a trap. Governance by extended male kin networks, which is what this subordinative syndrome sets you up for, leads to unfortunate outcomes for the group. Instability, violence, terror, corruption, and autocracy. Why? Because it's based upon a first political order of instability, domestic violence, domestic terror, domestic corruption, domestic autocracy. And furthermore, such a society will also experience other ramifications, such as poor health. If women are tasked with a particular gendered emphasis on healthcare, if you disempower women, you're going to disempower the health caretakers of your society. So things like poor health, poor food insecurity, low economic performance, rentierism, demographic woes, lack of attention to environmental security, because how you treat women and how you treat Mother Earth often parallel each other. In other words, what you do to your women, you do to your nation state. And so if you decide to curse your women, we argue that you will curse your nation state as well. Oftentimes when I give this presentation, I'm giving it to a national security audience. And I'll ask them, do you consider yourself a national security realist? And of course they all do. It's sort of oxymoronic to be a national security idealist these days. So I say, well, in light of these empirical findings, are you a realist if you believe the treatment of women does affect national security and stability? And taking it a step further, are you a realist if you believe then that the women, peace, and security agenda is absolutely in the national interest? But perhaps more importantly, can you consider yourself a realist? Can you call yourself a realist if you don't? Oftentimes we find, at least here at the Bush School, that still national security is considered a very womanless world. And what's happening with women has nothing to do with national security. But in light of these findings, which let me repeat, the US Department of Defense, as well as other funders such as the Compton Foundation helped us to provide, suggest otherwise. So at this point, I'm usually asked, well, then what would change? let's suppose that we accept that women matter. What would change in how we do business? So here's just a few thoughts, and we can expand on this afterwards. If the US isn't tracking the situation of women, how's it going to effectively anticipate instability in other countries? For example, if you're not examining bride price trajectories, I think you're missing a big part of the picture of anticipating instabilities in certain countries. So situational awareness is degraded, I think, if you are not looking at these variables. Subnational actors, if the United States is approaching a situation where a variety of subnational actors are vying for power, how will the US decide which subnational actors are most likely to bring stability in the long term if it's not first examining how they treat women and how they intend to treat women? And this is, I think, something that was completely missing when we were looking at proxy wars, say, within the Cold War period. How will the US avoid the trap of peace negotiations where the rights of women are bargained away to make peace between warlords if it doesn't understand the linkage between sustainable peace and the empowerment of women? How will the US track which of its own citizens are the greatest internal threat if domestic violence is not seen as domestic terror perpetration and treated seriously? We know from research that the not just the vast majority, but almost all of our domestic mass shooters and terrorists have been charged at some point with domestic violence against a mother, a sister, a girlfriend, a wife. We would argue that this makes perfect sense. How will the US rationally approach immigration policy if it doesn't understand it's not what country you come from, it's how you intend to treat women? That is the big clash of civilizations, probably a more important clash of civilizations than that put forward by Samuel Huntington. How will the US know that ending child marriage worldwide would probably do more for world peace than any other investment? We would argue, and research shows, that child marriage just mires populations in poverty and in ignorance and in lesser outcomes for children. And finally, when will the US know when exporting democracy makes sense and when it doesn't? We would argue that the US would be far more likely to be successful exporting democracy to what we would call transition nations that have transitioned away from some of these subordinative customs. And probably much less successful in nations where women are still severely subordinated. And the first political order is certainly not good ground for the export of democracy. And I guess in summary, I believe that one day the idea that foreign policy or national security policy could ignore the situation of women will be seen as laughably naive. I actually daydream about a time, maybe 30, 40 years from now, when people look back at our textbooks and kind of chuckle that we were missing this big part of the picture and didn't even notice it. I think they will kind of laugh at us.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter at New Security Beat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.